The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate
to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Northeast Credit Union,
helping their members save money through free checking accounts
and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union,
encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. From the Battle of Gettysburg to September 11th, the assassinations of Abraham Lincoln and John Kennedy, the moon landing, and the 30th anniversary of Star Wars, U.S. postage stamps have commemorated some of America's key historical and cultural moments. Beyond memorializing shared milestones, stamps tell a deeper story of American history and preferences and creativity and self-image. Chris West explores all of those layers of narrative in his book, A History of America in 36 Postage Stamps. Chris West, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you, Virginia.
The very first stamp in America was the result of the Stamp Act in 1765, which actually resulted in the Boston Tea Party. So America really started with a hatred of stamps. What was going on?
Well, it wasn't really a postage stamp. It was a revenue stamp. But if you're doing a history of America, you've really got to start round about the War of Independence. It was the first real example of taxation without representation. It meant that any printed paper had to have a stamp embossed on it, for which you had to pay the tax man for the privilege. So it's a bit like, I don't know, having a tax on emails or a tax on telephone conversations or something. It was a tax on communication. It really bit into people's lives in the way that taxation hadn't before. So it was very unpopular. And as things were in those days, politics was carried on in the streets, and effigies of the stamp commissioners were burnt in the streets. And there was a slogan, liberty, property, and no stamps.
When did the U.S. actually start using stamps for postage?
The first formal U.S. government stamps came out in 1847, when there was a 5 cent with Ben Franklin and a 10 cents with George Washington on. So that's really when it sort of officially began.
I have to stop you. 5 and 10 cents? That was a lot of money back then.
Yeah, it was, yes. I mean, you know, it was an expensive business getting post around the place in those days. We didn't, you know, there was a rider had to carry stuff through pretty rough country to get it from A to B. So it was an expensive business getting mail around.
How had letters been sent prior to these postage stamps in 1847?
Well, there had always been systems. Way back in 1639, there was a system whereby letters would arrive in Boston and they'd be taken to the house of a guy called Richard Fairbanks, and you could just come and pick the letters up. Like, you had to pay for the privilege. Then there were various attempts made at a kind of postal distribution system, most of which didn't work until 1711, and finally a system got off the ground. And of course, 20 years after that, Ben Franklin was postmaster of Philadelphia, and it sort of grew from there, really.
So Ben Franklin's image was on some of those first stamps. Also George Washington with the Roman numeral X. Now, what was going on there? What were they trying to communicate?
That's a very interesting question, and the answer is nobody knows. I was speaking to a collection of real expert philatelists last night in New York, and I asked this question and nobody knew the answer. But of course it does say a lot about George Washington. It shows that he was a man of sort of classical education. He'd read Roman and Greek writers. He was connected with the British sort of establishment in that way, in a way that Franklin wasn't. Franklin's very much a sort of self-taught guy.
And you talk about Franklin, the 1 cent Benjamin Franklin stamp. Now, this was
That came out in 1851.
Now, this stamp had entire books written about it. Why is it so beloved?
Well, there are so many varieties of it. Philatelists love variety. You know, if there's an extra dot in the left-hand corner, everyone goes nuts about it. So it's they love it. So, and because the technology was new, the printing, no two Ben Franklin 1851s are quite the same.
All of the stamps that we talked about, you know, these feature national leaders. When did the U.S. Postal Service depart from that tradition?
Well, they departed in 1869 when they came out with what I consider to be, and many other stamp collectors now, consider to be a beautiful series. My favourite is a picture of a wonderful Baldwin 24-ton locomotive on it with a great, you know, great big cow catcher and that great big smokestack, and you can just imagine it going across the Wild West. In 1869, nobody liked it. They hated it. Where's George Washington? They said, we don't want a locomotive on our stamps. We want George Washington. So the issue was removed, and they went back to showing national leaders.
But the reaction to the locomotive does raise a question. Were stamps more cherished back then? I mean, have they lost that kind of significance, the ability to rile the public through the years?
I don't think so, no. I think that people do take them seriously. I think, obviously, now... Well, the Potter one's a very interesting example of that, because there was quite a fuss about that, because they showed living people, and there's been a kind of unwritten rule that you don't show living people on US stamps. Mm-hmm. So the president doesn't get shown until he's passed away. And then there's Daniel Radcliffe on the stamp waving his wand around, and there's a living person. And the USPS say, well, it's not really a living person, it's a role played in a film. And that was quite controversial. A lot of people said, hey, this is breaking a long tradition, we don't like this.
Let's go back then to some of the earlier stamps. America started to use stamps in 1847. Now, 14 years later, it enters the Civil War. What kinds of changes do we see in stamps during that time?
Well, obviously the main one is you get two loads of stamps. You get the Union stamps, and the Confederates issued their own stamps. And they actually broke the rule. And they had a stamp with Jefferson Davis on it, who mm-hmm. was the president of the Confederate States of America. So you could argue, well, it wasn't a US stamp, so the rule is the same. But a stamp from what is now the USA, he was for many years the only living person to have been shown on a stamp.
You know what I think about, like, during that time, how important was postage to the country during that time?
It was incredibly important. I mean... You see it in these heartbreaking letters that people have from the front. No other war had had that before. The Civil War was kind of the first postal war, really.
But, of course, President Lincoln was also assassinated.
Yes, indeed.
Well, how soon was he memorialized by the Postal Service?
Well, he was memorialized a year after. There was a year of mourning, and then on April the 14th, 1866, a rather somber... black 15-cent stamp came out. He's looking rather haunted on it. It is a stamp of deep tragedy, I think, because that was such a tragedy for the nation.
We're speaking with Chris West. He's author of A History of America in 36 Postage Stamp. It's a glimpse of America's rich philatelic history, from George Washington's grave gaze to the charging buffalo of the Western frontier, Lindbergh's soaring biplane, and, of course, the skinny Elvis. American stamps give us a window into our past and our present. Well, stamps have such a strong message, you know, in addition to that, thinking of, you know, putting our national leaders, our symbols of democracy, on our stamps. When does the U.S. start to use stamps as kind of tools for propaganda, for messaging?
Well, the real king of that was FDR, who was a stamp collector and had been from his youth. And he understood very, very clearly the power of the stamp as a bearer of a message. And the stamps up until 1933 had been a bit cluttered. And he said, right, I want the stamps... bright colours, uncluttered, with a nice, clear, positive, upbeat message.
So they have stamps that, for example, were used to promote the New Deal, marking peace conferences. We have the first photograph of the Earth in the 1960s. But when do we actually start to see popular culture reflected in stamps? You mentioned Harry Potter, but that's fairly recent.
Well, it really comes in with a great blast at the beginning of the Clinton era. Suddenly the baby boomers are in charge, and it's shown very quickly on the stamps. I think, actually, to be precise, the decision had been made even before Clinton came to the White House, but it coincides with extraordinary accuracy and sort of appropriateness. The famous popular culture stamp of that era is the Elvis stamp.
Oh, right, when you got to vote for the fat or the skinny Elvis.
You got vote for the fat or the skinny, absolutely, that's right.
So, I'm sorry, refresh our memory on that. What was going on?
1993, they had a competition to see which of two designs of Elvis Presley people wanted on a stamp, and you could go into a post office and vote on a piece of paper. And there was a young Elvis and an old Elvis, and the young Elvis won, I think, quite convincingly. And the stamp came out, and it is a classic, and it is still the most collected US stamp.
I've been hearing an awful lot about the slow death of the US Postal Service for quite some time now. Where do you see the future of stamps?
Well, I just think they're going to tootle along. I mean, I don't... The problem is that nowadays a lot of the parcel post, for example, which is the booming sector, doesn't seem to use stamps. I think there's also a problem with a kind of philatelic inflation, that there's, you know, the more issues come out purely aimed at collectors, the more, in a sense, it becomes an artifice. The joy of stamp collecting is partially that this thing was stuck on a letter. And so, going back to the Civil War, there might have been a letter, a love letter, or a letter from someone who's dying or something. I mean, this was serious stuff. But just a sort of series of little bits of paper with Mickey Mouse on or something doesn't have the same depth of story to it. And I think the depth of story attached to the used stamps is part of their fascination.
Well, Chris West, wonderful speaking with you. Thank you.
Thank you, Virginia. It's been great.
Chris West, author of A History of America in 36 Postage Stamps, also A History of Britain in 36 Stamps. You'll find photos of some of the remarkable stamps that we talked about today, as well as others, on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. This time of year, they're everywhere, sitting for photos at the mall or ringing jingle bells outside of the grocery store. I'm speaking, of course, about Santas. While they may appear to be an indistinguishable mass of red velvet suits, rosy cheeks, and fake white beards, we wanted to take a closer look. Sean Hurley brings us the story of a surprisingly familiar Saint Nick.
Below a half moon, on a snowbound night, high on a hill in the town of Littleton, an unexpectedly large man with an overturned bucket of tangled hair stepped into the lobby of the Hampton Inn.
He was this, big, burly, strong guy.
For the hotel's night manager, Kristen Burkholder, it was hard to tell whether it was a damaged hip or knee that made the man's limp so pronounced. Burkholder noticed that the man's two front teeth were missing, that part of his right ear was gone.
He said that he travels with a Santa Claus costume, and if we wanted him to, he'd be happy to hang out in the lobby for an hour and read stories to the kids.
There wasn't any time to make an announcement or put up signs, and Burkholder still isn't sure why. She finally agreed to let the strange man sit in her hotel lobby.
I'm kind of thinking, oh my gosh, Santa's about to show up and this may backfire.
The man disappeared. He dressed in crimson robes and coal black boots. He tucked his wild hair into his Santa wig and drew the white hair down to cover his damaged ear and fixed a plate into his mouth so that Santa would have two front teeth. Red cap in place, he slung a bag full of toys over his shoulder and limped into the lobby.
But he sat down, and all of a sudden, within minutes, there was a line of kids just, you know, patiently waiting to sit on his lap and tell him what they want for Christmas.
Come on over here. Would you like to climb up here?
There you go. Yeah.
Are you looking forward to Christmas?
Yeah, and I saw Johnny.
You saw Johnny?
The owl.
Oh, where did you run into Johnny?
He went in our wreath.
Oh, he went in your wreath. Oh, that's a good place for an elf, right?
Yeah. He was so great. He was so, he was such a nice guy, super interactive. Very patient, very friendly.
None of the children and none of their parents knew who the man in the red suit was. That once upon a time, he'd been a kind of nightmare to kids all over the world. But by the time the line had cleared, one of the hotel staff had figured out Santa's real identity.
I have to get your autograph because my daughter's a wrestler.
Santa puts a shushing, secret finger to his lips.
Sorry, she was a wrestler. And she would love.
What's her name?
Carrie.
How do you spell that?
C-A-R-R-I-E. She would love it.
Weighing 287 pounds, Mankind!
He was born Mick Foley on Long Island, New York. His manifestations as Dude Love and Cactus Jack are infamous. But none are more deranged than mankind.
It was 1996 when Mick Foley belted a Hannibal Lecter mask over his face and stepped into the ring as Mankind, one of the darkest, most unhinged, most controversial, and most successful characters in professional wrestling history. The same year Mankind was born, 1996, Mick Foley visited Santa's Village in Jefferson, New Hampshire.
I was probably 16 or 17 when Mick first came to the park.
Christian Gaynor runs Santa's Village with his sister and brother-in-law. A third-generation owner, Gaynor's grandparents opened the park in 1953, and he grew up here.
You know, he was a WWE superstar. He was the guy on TV. I didn't approach him at all. I was like a half a dozen other employees, and we're just kind of following around, seeing what he did. And from place to place, all of our employees would get excited and ask him questions about wrestling and wrestling Hulk Hogan and all of the other big names of the WWE. But as his day kept on going, he kept on getting more inspired by the park and by the enthusiasm of our employees, and it just created a buzz for everybody, and there's been no turning back since.
I think I was able to explore that that darker side because I had the yearly visits to this place. I honestly feel like that helped me cope, that I could really be convincing in my bad guy mannerisms, because I had a really nice counterbalance in the, you know, in the joy of Christmas.
Every year he's here unannounced, he shows up, he's part of the family. We welcome him with open arms and his whole family.
As a matter of fact, it was on that roller coaster there, climbing the peak, that my daughter, who in 1998 would have been 4, kissed me on the cheek. And when I asked her what that kiss was for, she said, "Because you're a good man." And slightly more than 24 hours later, I was thrown off a massive steel structure by The Undertaker. And so after all these years, one of the great questions I have is, what in the world was I doing at Santa's Village the day before the biggest match of my career?
Not only the biggest match in his career, Hell in a Cell is considered one of the great events in WWE history, and saw Mankind being thrown not once, but twice from a height of 16 feet. The first fall was highly planned and well practiced, but the second, which knocked him unconscious, was an accident. The injuries he sustained during Hell in a Cell hastened the end of his formal wrestling career in 2000.
But yeah, I just remember that. Going up there, kissing me on the cheek, telling me I was a good man.
Does that create any kind of conflict for you when you think about those two things together?
Not a conflict. I mean, it's a great paradox. But I learned to live with it.
In 1999, during an autograph session, Foley got the sense that his days as Mankind were coming to an end, and that another character, maybe his last, was preparing to emerge.
And off in the distance, about halfway through this massive line, I saw this little boy with the telltale scars of many, many surgeries for severe burns.
Foley called the boy up to the front of the line.
But it was then that his mother told me that Antonio had needed to wear a mask during the process of his healing. At the time, he was 3, and like most 3-year-olds, wanted nothing to do with the wearing of a mask, until his mother told him that his favorite wrestler, Mankind, wore a mask. And it kind of filled me with this sense of joy. It was almost like I could feel my conscience calling out to me. And so I asked his mom if he could sit on my lap while I took care of the rest of the people in line. And people were visibly moved. Like, there were people wiping away tears. And as he walked away, I got this distinct feeling that I knew what it was like to be Santa Claus, and a distinct feeling like that this was something I would like to experience again.
And so he did. After visiting Sierra Leone in 2008, Foley funded construction of a large primary school there, which was completed in 2009. In 2011 alone, as a volunteer for the Rape, Abuse, and Incest National Network, Foley logged more than 550 hours talking to victims. Following Hurricane Sandy, Foley gave his dining room furniture to a Long Island family who'd lost theirs in the storm. He then promptly invited himself over for dinner, so he could eat at his old table one last time. In 2012, it became official.
I have an official ambassador's letter that proclaims me an official ambassador, so that anytime I put on the red suit, I am officially known as Santa Mick.
Foley was inducted into the WWE Hall of Fame in 2013. He knew exactly how he wanted to go out, exactly how he wanted to leave his fans.
I tried to talk Mr. McMahon into allowing me to exit Madison Square Garden on a sleigh flying into the sky. And I knew he had the capability of making it happen. He just didn't understand why it was so important to me.
And so, below a half moon, on a snowbound night, high on a hill in the town of Littleton, an unexpectedly large man with an overturned bucket of tangled hair stepped into the lobby of the Hampton Inn.
And you, young man, what would you like for Christmas?
Maroon catching gear.
Maroon catching gear. I can do that.
None of the children and none of their parents knew who the man in the red suit was. They called him Santa, and they knew inside him lay all the goodness and all the care and all the mystery and hope. Inside him, the single, simple majesty we believe exists in the very heart of all of mankind. For word of mouth, and yes, Virginia, there is a Mick Foley. This is Sean Hurley.
It's taken decades and a massive shift in gaming demographics to make clear that video games are not just for kids. Recently, millions of adults have been buying another item that was once thought of as for children only, coloring books. It's all part of a larger trend of products and experiences, from footsie pajamas to summer camp, that cater to grown-ups who long to get back in touch with their childhood experiences. In Brooklyn, adults can even attend preschool, where they make crafts with glitter glue and have nap time. Call it regression or therapy, Adrian Raffel wrote about what is being called the Peter Pan market for the New Yorker magazine. And Adrian, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks so much for having me.
So what are some of the best-selling adult coloring books now?
Well, one of them is by, well, two of them are by this Scottish artist named Joanna Basford, and her first book was called Secret Garden, an inky treasure hunt and coloring book. Inky treasure, I love that. And then her second one was Enchanted Forest, an inky quest, and she draws them by hand in her studio in Scotland, and they just completely took off.
They're beautiful books. I went and looked at her website, and when I started looking into them, I found that people that I know love these coloring books. I was a little shocked.
You know, it's funny. I was talking about this the other day to a friend of mine who's in the same PhD program as I am, and she said, oh, yeah, I used those coloring books when I was, you know, working on, stressed out about final papers. My friend gave me Joanna Basford's books, and I just, like, they worked.
Well, what do you think is behind their popularity, and how popular are they, by the way?
Well, so Joanna Basford's books aren't the only ones out there. There's a Creative Haven series by Dover. There's lots of these books in England and in France. But to give you an example, this spring, Joanna Basford's Secret Garden and Enchanted Forest were sold out on Amazon for weeks, and they were just like the two best-selling books, and you couldn't get them. I mean, you couldn't get them on Amazon for weeks.
So that's pretty significant. But well, why do you think people are gravitating towards coloring books for adults?
There's a sort of combination of things. I think there's this soothing effect of them, and they can both like sort of be as artistic as possible, but also there's zero pressure. And there's something about these books that is neither childlike, like you don't feel like you're sort of coloring in an outline of a character from a TV show or of like a little bunny or a bow or something, but also, you know, they're really sophisticated, intricate designs. They sort of put you into this is what proponents of them and people I've talked to who love them say, they put you into this kind of meditative, focused space that you just don't get in the rest of everyday life, especially sort of staring at screens all the time.
Hmm. What are some of the other components of this Peter Pan market that you write about?
So one of the ones that I really loved looking into is Michelle Joni, this woman in Brooklyn who started an adult preschool camp where adults go and they like live by a superhero name while they're in preschool, and they have nap time and they have glitter and they have, you know, school pictures, and they have all the things that are like sort of form the components of your first memories, but you're doing them as you're 30 or 40 or whatever years old instead of when you're four. And, you know, it seems kind of ridiculous at first.
To the people who are putting on this camp, I mean, is there any sense of irony about it? Or they, I mean, what are they trying to do exactly?
So I think that it's a combination of this sort of like of a sense of like irony, almost beyond irony. Like, no one could possibly take this seriously. So why not just go as completely ridiculous as possible and like go with the sort of, I think it's the idea that like if you sort of let loose and go with kind of this like crazily ridiculous idea in your spare time, you know, maybe that'll kind of loosen you up in the rest of your life so you can enjoy everything that you do and kind of have a little bit more spark in just kind of your daily proceedings.
It seems like there's a lot of nostalgia here, and I'm wondering, just because I'm reading another book right now about hovering parents and, you know, the damage that the helicopter parent can do, is this kind of idea that millennials or the generation of adults now wish to be protected? I'm not sure what's behind it.
So some of the people I did speak to, some experts I spoke to, who were a little bit more maybe skeptical or incredulous of the progression of this trend, did worry that, you know, is this kind of a regression for millennials? Is this some sort of reaching back to a safer place, as you say, because of the both the kind of the competitive pressures growing up and then the, like, pressures that you're facing, you know, like it sort of parallels a trend of 20-somethings moving back into their parents' houses for very serious economic reasons. And then there's sort of maybe the darker flip side of all this kind of cheery glitter glue is this because we're having this kind of economically forced second childhood is one of the theories going around. And, you know, I wonder about that. I wonder, is that behind some of this really kind of almost aggressive, like, reclaiming of the childhood that one perhaps never had?
But you also write that this is not the first time that recessions give rise to these kind of, I don't know, let's say recess-like activities.
Yeah. It's funny, in a recession, you know, in the 80s during the recession, the hula hoop, which was big in the 50s, all of a sudden came back into prominence. They were remarketing the hula hoop as, like, de-stress by, you know, getting back to your inner child. So as much as, you know, people are sort of worrying maybe or questioning the inner child coming out now, this has been a thing that has persisted for generations and generations back.
Do you think this trend of the adult coloring books and YA literature we can include in that, you know, summer camps for kids, preschool for kids, is it something that's going to stick around, or will it just rotate like the hula hoop? I'm sorry.
You know, no, I like that. You know, I feel like the general structure of the trend is going to stick around. What's sort of on the table, be it hula hoops or coloring books or silly putty or, you know, toy archery things, you know, what people are using to express their inner child is definitely, I feel like, will probably end up rotating.
Well, Adrienne, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Adrienne Raffel, she is contributing writer for The New Yorker, and that's where we found her article, Why Adults Are Buying Coloring Books for Themselves. And you'll find a link to read it yourself at wordofmouthradio.org.